This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater, presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices in his community that they've made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 5th, 11th, and 12th at 2 p.m. at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com, appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBLO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Pierre has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Lewin, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
A dismal fall run of Chinook salmon to the Klamath River could force the first ever shutdown of the commercial fishing season.
An outspoken Arizona environmental activist is in federal custody after a court hearing yesterday.
Philippines President Gloria Arroyo declared a state of emergency today.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,287 officially acknowledged deaths of U.S. soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,119 civilians have been reported killed by military aggression in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. The Oregon Public Utility Commission today approved a $9.4 billion sale of PacifiCorp to utility speculator Warren Buffett's holding company. PacifiCorp is Oregon's second largest electrical utility, serving 555,000 customers. It also sells power to five other states, all of which had to approve the sale before today's green light. Buffett's company, Mid-American Energy Holding Company, is based in Des Moines, Iowa. The corporation received antitrust law clearance by the Federal Trade Commission on February 7th, paving the way for the acquisition. PUC Chair Lee Beyer told KBOO this afternoon that Buffett may well choose to sell off PacifiCorp for profit after a few years, but that such a sale would be subject to PUC and federal approval. However, Beyer added that Buffett has promised he will not sell the utility. In related news, PacifiCorp yesterday applied to the PUC to increase rates more than 13%.
A dismal run of Chinook salmon this fall to the Klamath River could force the first ever shutdown of the commercial season from Cape Falcon in Oregon to Point Sur in California. Biologists are expecting only 29,000 spawning salmon to return to the Klamath for the fall Chinook run. That's 6,000 fish below the minimum for conservation. It's the lowest return since 1992. In a good year, the salmon trolling season would begin March 15th and run through October. Last year, only about half of that season was allowed to go forward because of declining runs. The Klamath Basin has traditionally been one of the more productive salmon river systems in the West Coast, but dams, irrigation battles, and declining water quality have made it an obstacle course for the remaining fish that attempt to spawn.
Walmart will shrink the size of its proposed Gresham store in a second attempt to win approval for the development. The Portland suburb rejected Walmart's first application last year for the reason traffic generated by the store would jam nearby intersections. During the peak Saturday shopping hour, the larger store was expected to generate more than 1,000 car trips. Walmart proposed improving roads and signals near the store to increase traffic flow. However, Gresham's planners ruled out one of the changes was unsafe. After losing an appeal to the city's hearings officer in November, Walmart bought the land for nearly $8 million and went back to the drawing board to reduce the size of the proposed store. Neighborhood leaders say they are not sure that cutting the size of the store will actually decrease traffic by the same amount.
Oregon education officials and the small business community are joining together to express concern over President Bush's 2007 budget following a new report from the Washington, D.C.-based Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The report points out millions of dollars in cuts to Oregon education and job training. KBOO's Kirk Vandeveer reports.
Oregon is set to lose $75 million for K-12 education and almost $90 million for state programs that help promote literacy and job training. Gene Evans with the Oregon Department of Education says the federal share of Oregon's educational budget is critical.
The proposed reductions will hurt schools in every county in the state. This is one of the most drastic cuts to education in a decade.
Christine Chin Ryan with Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership says without a trained and qualified workforce, businesses will go elsewhere.
We talk about losing jobs, then what are we doing to keep it here? Cutting education and not focusing on what we need to do with education and workforce training to compete in the global market.
Governor Kulongowski has already voiced concerns about the proposed budget cuts. The president says the cuts are necessary to help slash the soaring budget deficit. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vandeveer, KBOO News.
The international relief organization Clowns Without Borders has its biggest local event of the year tomorrow night. Here, in the studio with us, to talk about the group is Sarah Leanna Foster. Sarah, thank you for coming down to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Please tell us about Clowns Without Borders. What do you do?
Clowns Without Borders sends performers to relieve suffering through laughter in different parts of the world in crisis. We focus particularly on children who've experienced trauma due to being in refugee camps or in areas that have experienced natural disaster.
All right. We laugh to survive.
Yes.
I have that on a little card in my kitchen.
I think it's true.
Uh-huh. We understand that you have been to Haiti and recently returned from South Africa. Can you tell us what you did and where exactly you went to perform?
Well, last month when I was in South Africa, we spent about half of the time outside of Johannesburg in different townships and the other half outside of Durban, both in areas that had been hit hard by the AIDS epidemic. And we performed clown shows and taught workshops to primarily orphans.
How does it help to do clown shows in a disaster area? What is it really like for the families and the children, and what does it mean to them?
Well, I think sometimes going into the show, it was amazing to see how excited children would be. We'd drive into a pretty poor area where houses would sometimes be made of we'd see houses made of tarps and pieces of corrugated iron, and then drive in, and the kids would be so excited they would almost, one time kids almost pushed down the wall of the building where we were getting ready to do the show because they wanted to see it. And then afterwards they would act out parts of it, parts of the show that we'd just done, which really brought home how much sometimes they remembered it made a difference to them.
All right. What else do you do outside of performing?
Well, we also teach clown workshops mostly to kids. We were at orphanages and different orphan centers, and we actually got to stay for about a week at a time at a couple of orphanages and do residencies that culminated in the kids themselves performing shows.
Are there many orphanages as far as you know?
I think that there are quite a few. We spent time at two long-term and visited probably 8 or 10 other ones during our short stay there. And the kids were so excited, especially we built 10 pairs of stilts, and they couldn't get enough of the stilts. They were really excited. They juggled and did little clown sketches.
And Sarah, what do you do when you're not volunteering with the clowns?
I perform, we create and perform shows with the Nomadic Theater Company here in town, and also teach school residencies. And we're getting ready for the big show tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. So that is about, the event is tomorrow night?
It's tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Winningstad Theater, which is at 1111 Southwest Broadway. And it's going to feature live music by Shoehorn and the Von Tapp Quartet and some of the best physical and vaudevillian performers in town.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was all the questions we had so far and the time. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. That was Sarah Liana Foster of Clowns Without Borders. Find out more about the group on the web at clownswithoutborders.org or go to comedytricks.com.
A federal grand jury in Eugene has indicted two more people in the 2001 arson at a Klatskanai tree farm, bringing the number charged in the case to six. In all, 14 people are charged in what government prosecutors describe as an arson conspiracy across several western states over 5 years. 24-year-old Nathan Fraser Block and 28-year-old Joanna Zacher were arrested yesterday in Olympia, Washington, after the 14-count indictments were handed up. Government attorneys will seek their return to Eugene to face trial. The two are charged with arson and attempted arson and with carrying and using a destructive device in relation to a crime of violence. The latter charge alone carries a minimum 30-year sentence.
During our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. hear Bread and Roses. At 7 it's Jay's Place with J.J. Johnson. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Corvallis can expect partly cloudy skies with fog developing and a low of 29 degrees. In the Gorge it will be cloudy with a low of 28. Tomorrow partly sunny with highs around 50 degrees. Corvallis can expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 53 degrees, and in the Gorge, there will be a high of 50. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The former head of the 9/11 Commission is criticizing the Bush administration for the port operations deal recently made with the United Arab Emirates. Thomas Kane says the deal, quote, never should have happened, and the quicker we get out of the deal, the better. He notes that two of the September 11 hijackers came from the UAE and that money was laundered through the country. Kane calls the deal and subsequent fallout a no-win situation. He predicts the deal won't go through, but he questions how much damage will be caused before it's killed. Kane says the uproar over the agreement must look like anti-Arab sentiment to the UAE.
An outspoken Arizona environmental activist is in federal custody after a court hearing yesterday. FSRN's Evan Davis reports from Arizona.
Environmental activist Rod Coronado was arraigned yesterday in a federal court in Tucson, Arizona, after federal agents arrested him on Wednesday. During yesterday's court appearance, Coronado was charged with felony distribution of information relating to a destructive device for allegedly giving instructions on how to create an incendiary device during a speech he gave in San Diego in 2003. A San Diego area housing development that was under construction was destroyed by arson less than 24 hours before Coronado's speech there, but Coronado is not being charged with setting the blaze, which Earth Liberation Front took credit for at the time. Coronado is being held in detention in Tucson and is expected to be transferred on Monday to a federal court in San Diego. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Arizona.
As the country of Iraq remains tense with the continued presence of U.S. and coalition troops, a U.S. congressman who previously supported the war and sits on the House Appropriations Committee has called for troops to return. FSRN's Rebecca Miles files this story.
In New Jersey yesterday, Democratic Congress member Steve Rothman said he backed President Bush after the attacks on September 11th, accepting his counsel that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat. Rothman said after Hussein was deposed by the military, it turned out virtually everything President Bush had told the American people and Congress was untrue.
There was no imminent threat to the national security of the United States. Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction, and he was not sending Iraqi agents into our country. But because of the horrific management of the war, really without a strategy by the Bush administration, the country, its infrastructure was nearly all destroyed. The people were thrown out of their jobs. The middle class was dispersed. Many of us felt we had a moral responsibility to stay in that country to help these people establish a stable government, hopefully a democratic government. It's now been 3 years since the war began, and we've lost 2,200 young servicemen and women of our country, more than 16,000 wounded, more than 100,000 Iraqi dead, more than a quarter of $1 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money spent on this war, with virtually no progress in terms of reconstructing the country or providing stability. We have done more than enough, paid the price in blood and money. It is time to bring our troops home.
Rayed Jarrah is an Iraqi citizen who's currently in the U.S. and lived in Iraq through the invasions and has written the Iraqi Roadmap, an exit plan, and thinks civil war is only likely if the U.S. troops stay.
There is an ongoing civil tension and clashes since the invasions that are happening, with so many casualties every week. But, I mean, there is no possibility that Iraqis will start having big-scale civil war like the Lebanese case. Iraq currently is like a room full of gas that will explode. It just needs one spark to explode. And the U.S. Army should not be there anymore.
As Congressmember Rothman added, President Bush will be regarded as the worst, if not the worst ever, president in U.S. history. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
A bill to ban nearly all abortions has passed the South Dakota legislature, and it's on its way to the governor's desk. Governor Mike Rounds has indicated he will sign the measure. Under the legislation, doctors in the state would face up to 5 years in prison for performing an abortion unless it's necessary to save the mother's life. The bill is aimed at reversing Roe v. Wade, the 1973 landmark decision that legalized abortion. South Dakota lawmakers think passage of the bill will prompt the Supreme Court to reverse itself on abortion now that there are two new justices, John Roberts and Samuel Alito. Planned Parenthood has said if the measure is signed into law, it will challenge it in court.
It's 5:18. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
You've probably heard of Jerry Lewis, the comedian. But you've probably not heard of Jerry Lewis, the congressional clown. And the clown is the one who has me in stitches from laughing so hard at his antics. Lewis is a Congress critter from California, and he's a master of legislative slapstick. In 2003, for example, he pulled a rabbit out of his hat for an investment fund named Cerberus. Back then, Lewis was chairman of the powerful House subcommittee that doles out our tax dollars to various corporations that make weaponry and such under Pentagon contracts. Cerberus had a huge stake in a company that had one of these contracts, and it was not going well due to cost overruns, delays, and management foul-ups. Lewis himself had criticized this contract, and in May of 2003, a move was made to cut $160 million out of its funding. But in June, Lewis suddenly reached into his hat and restored all of the funds. Why? It seems that in that 1 month interim, someone from Cerberus had told Lewis that the company wanted to hold a fundraising dinner in New York for his political committee. Sure enough, on July 7th, Lewis flew to New York, sacked up $110,000, and returned the very next day to get the full House to pass the Pentagon funding bill, including the $160 million that Cerberus wanted. Lewis, always looking for a laugh line, now says he did nothing wrong. "I'm darn sensitive to make certain we keep arm's length on such deals," he deadpanned. Then, honking his clown horn and giving a huge stage wink, Lewis said, "At a fundraising meeting, I do not discuss business." And here's the line that still has me laughing out loud. Lewis says, "To this day, I don't know what their interest might be." This is Jim Hightower saying, do you think their interest might be to swap $110,000 of their money for $160 million of ours? Stop it, Jerry. You're killing us. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Philippine President Gloria Arroyo declared a state of emergency today amid massive anti-government demonstrations and an alleged coup plot. Gurley Linayo reports from Manila for Free Speech Radio News.
Clashes broke out between policemen and protesters a few hours after President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo declared a state of emergency, sparking a security crackdown. Rallies were banned, classes were suspended, and security was stepped up around the presidential palace. In declaring emergency rule, Arroyo ordered the military and police to hunt down those believed to be behind a plot to overthrow her government. Officials said under the state of emergency, the government can also take over utilities and companies that threaten national interests, including media agencies. The Philippines was placed under emergency rule as it celebrated the 20th anniversary of a people power revolt that ousted late dictator Ferdinand Marcos in 1986 and restored democracy. Former President Corazon Aquino, who was propelled into power by the 1986 uprising, was among more than 15,000 people who defied the ban on rallies and marched to again call for Arroyo's resignation.
I have no intention to violate our laws. My only appeal is the same appeal I made when I went to the presidential palace last year when I asked President Gloria Arroyo
to make the supreme sacrifice of resigning. And I would like to reiterate that call.
Arroyo's opponents warn she has practically placed the country under a de facto martial rule. They urge Filipinos to be vigilant and not to allow democracy to be stolen again. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Linao in Manila.
A Nigerian court has ordered Shell Petroleum to pay $1.5 billion to local communities in the Niger Delta region as compensation for years of environmental pollution. FSRN's Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
The court judgment is another setback for the oil giant Shell, which early this week shut down half of its operations in Nigeria following attacks on its facilities after the kidnapping of 9 of its foreign employees. Payment of compensation for environmental damage is one of the demands of the local militants holding the oil workers. Nigeria's National Assembly had previously passed a resolution compelling Shell to pay the $1.5 billion for ecological damage. The case went to court when Shell refused to pay. If Shell does not comply with today's court verdict, negotiations to secure the release of the hostages could become even more difficult. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Saudi officials say two guards were critically injured while stopping suicide bombers from blowing up the world's largest oil processing facility. Officials say two cars packed with explosives were detonated outside the gates, and the attackers were killed when guards opened fire. The Saudi oil minister says the blast did not affect operations at the facility, refuting an earlier television report that the flow of oil was halted briefly after a pipeline was damaged. There is no immediate word on who is behind the attack, which is the first on an oil facility in Saudi Arabia.
In Ecuador, the government-imposed state of emergency has been lifted in the Amazon province of Napo. This comes after troops were sent to the region to deal with protests against foreign and state-owned oil interests. Earlier in the week, protesters had occupied a pumping station that supplies the country's most important privately owned pipeline. They were calling for greater investment in the region. The government has now reportedly agreed to spend some $100 million on infrastructure projects and social programs.
A daytime curfew for Baghdad and the region around it is being extended for a second day. Officials say the order keeping most people off the streets made for the calmest day since a major Shiite mosque was bombed. Another Shiite monument escaped damage when rockets were fired at a village southeast of Baghdad. That's the KBU Evening News for Friday, February 24th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kbu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderweer. Our assistant producer is Martha Odom, and tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporter Kirk Vanderweer, and our engineer is Joshua Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman interviews herbalist and writer Andrew Gator, author of Healing Skin Disorders, Natural Treatments for Dermatological Conditions. At 10:30, Chris Andre hosts Earth Watch, and at 11 o'clock, Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Thomas Jefferson said, "Look forward to distant times."
Good night, Liam.
Good night, Annalisa.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, recent reports on Guantanamo Bay detainees from the UN Human Rights Commission, Seton Hall University, and the National Journal raise grave questions about everything from whether detainees are being tortured to why many are even being held. Despite these sensational findings, the reports have received little attention. We'll talk to Slate.com editor and legal commentator Dahlia Lithwick about Guantanamo. Also on the program, the findings of the third Global Media Monitoring Project on women in journalism are out, and they look depressingly like the findings of the first and second projects. All around the world, it seems, you'll find women underrepresented in stories, marginalized to soft news, and presented as victims. So what's to be done? We'll hear from Sheila Gibbons, editor of the quarterly Media Report to Women and author of Taking Their Place, a documentary history of women in journalism. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has been making a lot of noise lately about how the U.S. should fight the public relations battle in the so-called War on Terror. He unveiled some of his newest rhetoric at a speech before the Council on Foreign Relations on February 17th, saying that, quote, "some of the most critical battles may not be in the mountains of Afghanistan or the streets of Iraq, but in newsrooms in places like New York, London, Cairo, and elsewhere," close quote. You'd think such a line would be a red flag for journalists, but the call for even greater manipulation of public information got surprisingly light media pickup. It's too bad because the public definitely needs someone to keep an eye on what Rumsfeld is up to. All the while saying what he really wants is for accurate information to get out, Rumsfeld blasted the press for exposing a Pentagon propaganda program in Iraq that planted stories in Iraqi newspapers. He spoke enthusiastically about creating more government propaganda outlets, or as he put it, quote, "embracing new institutions to engage people around the world," close quote. and he complained about criticism of the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, saying, quote, "By golly, that place is being run. There's no torture. There's no abuse," close quote. Rumsfeld insisted that in the war of information, the United States lags far behind its supposed enemies, but that, quote, "truth is on our side, and ultimately, truth wins out," close quote. If his other statements didn't already make that sound absurd, he underscored his bizarre relationship to truth just a few hours after the speech when he told PBS host Charlie Rose that the Pentagon program that planted stories in Iraqi media had been halted once it was exposed. Pentagon spokespeople have subsequently acknowledged that Rumsfeld's claim was false.
On February 20th, MSNBC's Chris Matthews interviewed Paul Hackett, the Iraq veteran and anti-war activist who recently pulled out of the Democratic senatorial primary race in Ohio. Matthews said to Hackett, quote, "You know, I, as a journalist and as a person who loves to watch big debates in this country, was hoping that your race would be one of the races in that country we could all watch this November and say, now there's a guy who thinks the war in Iraq is wrong, the wrong policy. He's taken on the policy. The voters are going to get to vote on this war. Now they don't get that chance, do they? Because you pulled out." Close quote. It seems like an odd thing for Matthews to say for more than one reason. For one thing, Hackett pulling out means that the Democratic Senate candidate in Ohio will be Representative Sherrod Brown, who voted against the authorization to use force against Iraq and has been a consistent opponent of the war. More consistent, some observers note, than Paul Hackett. With Brown facing off against incumbent Senator Mike DeWine, voters will still have a chance to vote for or against the war. But perhaps the more obvious point is that, as the host of a TV show, Matthews shouldn't have to wait for congressional candidates in order to get those big debates he claims to love. Matthews even pointed out later in the program that a majority of Americans, 56% in a recent Gallup poll, took an anti-war position. And yet, he said, quote, "it's still treated as a weird marginal minority weirdo issue, like, oh, you're anti-war, you're kind of out there. It's a strange disconnect," close quote. Actually, it's not that strange. And if Chris Matthews really doesn't know, someone should explain to him that what makes a popular position seem weird and marginal is when TV networks like MSNBC exclude and marginalize it in public conversation.
On February 15th, ABC investigative reporter Brian Ross delivered an exclusive report on World News Tonight and Nightline that purported to be a bombshell. ABC had obtained tape-recorded conversations from mid-1995 that, according to Ross, quote, "will only serve to fuel the continuing debate about Saddam's true intentions and whether he, in fact, did hide weapons of mass destruction," close quote. But viewers were left in the dark about information undermining the tape's most important revelations. ABC emphasized the excerpts of a conversation between Saddam Hussein and his weapons chief and son-in-law, Hussein Kamel, in which Kamel is heard telling Hussein that Iraq had misled weapons inspectors about the extent of weapons stockpiles. ABC suggested that these admissions might provide new insight into the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq a decade later. But the tapes are hardly news. Kamel, who defected from Iraq in 1995, talked at great length with UN weapons inspectors and the CIA that year, and even publicly stated on CNN that Hussein had ordered the weapons programs concealed. More importantly, but not explained in ABC's report, Kamel also repeatedly emphasized that Iraq had destroyed all its stocks of usable unconventional weapons in 1991. He said this both publicly on CNN and to UN and U.S. officials. Kamel said that by destroying the weapons, Saddam Hussein hoped to conceal how far Iraq had gotten in developing weapons with the intent of restarting these programs after the inspection regime was ended. Despite this knowledge, the Bush administration found selective citation of Kamel's testimony very helpful in making its case that Iraq had hidden stockpiles of banned weapons, including in Colin Powell's crucial February 2003 speech to the UN. But while it's clear why the administration would want to obscure inconvenient facts about what was really known before the war about Iraq's weapons, what is unclear is why the media would do so, and even less clear why they should continue to do so 3 years later.
The New York Times put its thin skin on display recently when it rejected a prospective intern because it didn't like his journalism professor's views. When Kejal Vyas, a student at New Jersey's Rutgers University campus in Newark, applied to the Times for an internship, his application was impressive, including, among other things, a long internship and several bylines working for Newark's Star-Ledger, New Jersey's biggest newspaper. But instead of being judged on his merits, Vyas was penalized because one of his journalism professors, Alan Wolper, is an occasional critic of the New York Times. The Times rejection notice to Vyas was curt and unprofessional. Quote, "Hi, Kejal. Based on what Alan Wolper has written about us, I cannot imagine that he would want one of his students to intern here. I guess if we need students from New Jersey, we will go elsewhere. Best, Nancy." Close quote. Nancy is Nancy Sharkey, a New York Times senior editor and recruiter. But she wasn't alone. When Professor Wolper asked the Times about the rejection of the young man he called his best student for a column he was writing for editor and publisher, he found Times executives standing by Sharkey and dismissing her dig at him as a harmless matter of snideness. Wolper was also told the Times executive editor, Bill Keller, would not discuss the matter with him. As Mark Goodman, the executive director of the Student Press Law Center, told Wolper, quote, "The message here for journalism professors is that if you want your students to get an internship at the New York Times, you don't criticize the Times in what you write," close quote. Goodman also neatly summed up the episode of Times pettiness, calling the whole thing grossly inappropriate and unfair.
Finally, we don't usually credit journalists for leaving something out of a story, but it seems appropriate for the February 19th 60-minute story on global warming. Unlike many another media exploration of the topic, this piece, hosted by Scott Pelley, did not include sources denying the existence of climate change or human responsibility for that. Asked why not by CBSNews.com, Pelley pointed to the remarkable unanimity on the issue in the scientific community. He noted that the segment included experts from the National Academy of Science and NASA and said, quote, "It would be irresponsible of us to go find some scientist somewhere who is not thought of as being eminent in the field and put him on television with these other guys to cast doubt on what they're saying," close quote. Pelley noted that even the Reagan administration had come around on the need to reduce chlorofluorocarbons, and that he thought the Bush White House would reach a similar tipping point on other climate-related issues. If they do, it may have much to do with media like 60 Minutes ceasing to provide them cover for their inaction with a false debate.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
In recent weeks, three reports have emerged providing new information about Guantanamo detainees, who they are, and how they are being treated. The independent reports published by the National Journal, a Seton Hall University professor, and the UN Human Rights Commission raise questions about everything from whether many of the detainees should even be held at all, to whether they are being exposed to torture and inhumane treatment. Despite the weighty issues involved, these reports haven't received lavish treatment by news organizations. Joining us now to talk about Guantanamo is Slate.com editor and legal expert Dahlia Lithwick. Her column, Invisible Men, The Not People We're Not Holding at Guantanamo Bay, is available on Slate.com and includes links to each of the three reports. Welcome to Counterspin, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thanks for having me.
Dahlia, tell us about these three reports. What do they tell us about Guantanamo?
Well, two of them were studies of the charges against the detainees, and one was a study of the conditions. The two sort of legal studies were published. One was published by the National Journal about 2.5 weeks ago. That was a review of all the documents that came out of the 132 combatant status review tribunals. That's the screening process whereby the administration says we're taking a look and making sure these folks are all enemy combatants. There's a lot of problems with those screenings. The detainees are presumed guilty.
Mm-hmm.
They are allowed to have all sorts of crazy hearsay evidence. They're not allowed to know the evidence against them. But the National Journal went through and reviewed those. The other study came out of Seton Hall University in New Jersey, one of the authors was a professor there. The other is his brother, and they represent some of the detainees. Similarly, they looked at the government documents that were produced in preparation for these combatant status review tribunals. In both cases, the authors came away saying overwhelmingly, as many as 80% of these detainees said the National Journal studies were never al-Qaeda. Very, very few of them are accused of anything other than associating with terrorists, which might mean something as limited as staying at a guest house or claiming to have known a terrorist. Many of them are only implicated because of the confessions of other detainees. And I think one of the most overwhelming things that you get out of both studies is that most of these folks were not captured in Afghanistan, not captured on the battlefield. They were picked up often in Pakistan and very often in exchange for bounty. It basically with Taliban warlords saying, oh, you know, here's this guy, now give me my check for, you know, $1,000.
Yeah, I found it interesting that according to the Seton Hall study, 86% were picked up by either the Northern Alliance or in Pakistan at a time when the U.S. was offering large bounties.
Exactly, and the Seton Hall study contains this incredibly damning sort of commercial that was on a flyer that was tacked up that said, quote, get wealth and power beyond your dreams. You too can get millions of dollars, you know, take care of your livestock and your doctors and your school books. So there was such an incentive to falsify information, and it's just not clear at all from either of these studies that the majority of the people in Guantanamo were guilty of anything other than being just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Now, the other study was the UN Human Rights Commission study. Tell us about that.
That's right. And that study was not set up to review the charges against the detainees. All they wanted to do, they had 18 rapporteurs who essentially looked at the claims about the human rights conditions in Guantanamo. They interviewed family members. They interviewed detainees who had been let go. They came away with the absolute unequivocal finding that Guantanamo needs to be closed down. These people need to be tried in a court of law, that the punishment amounts to torture in some cases. They were particularly concerned about the claims of force feeding of the hunger strikers and the rapporteurs, who, by the way, were not allowed to speak to the detainees, so they chose not to come to Guantanamo, came away saying there is no question that international law of human rights is absolutely being violated on Guantanamo Bay.
You know, the UN Human Rights Commission recommendation to close down Guantanamo and some of its other recommendations was one of the few things that did break through and get some media coverage, if most of it was just a report on outrage by U.S. officials. But here we have three studies with sensational revelations and lots of information. How has this all been covered, in your view?
Shockingly ignored, to the point that, you know, you can go in and do a Lexis search and find just a fistful of reports. I think that where it is reported, if at all, is in the foreign presses. In other words, that National Journal study got reported more in Australia than it did in the United States.
Well, according to the Columbia Journalism Review Daily, the UN Human Rights Commission report detailing, among other things, the torture and inhumane treatment, quote, was met with a chorus of yawns, close quote. Your findings weren't much different than that.
I think that's true. I mean, I think that the report was essentially presented as, well, we all sort of knew this anyway. I mean, there have been accounts of torture going on at Guantanamo for years now, and so there was a feeling that this isn't news. And in fact, I think you're right. What became news at the end of the day was the administration's outrage and the administration's sort of facetious claims that, well, these folks weren't here in the first place, you know, sort of neglecting to say they weren't there because you told them they couldn't talk to anyone. So I think that there is a real question about, you know, A, this was not perceived as news at all. This was sort of been there, done that. And then B, it was in the newspapers for a nanosecond and then gone. There was no consequence. There was very little op-ed writing. There was very little commentary, very little fallout at all.
Do you think there are other reasons why these three reports received so little attention?
Well, I think it's a larger problem with the sort of thinking of, in this country, about the war on terror, which is, you know, we've divided the world starkly into us and them. And if it happens to us, it's interesting. If it happens to them, including Hamdi and Padilla, including warrantless wiretapping, including Guantanamo, then it's just not interesting because they are sort of by definition all terrorists. And so the nuance of, you know, are they al-Qaeda, are they Taliban, are they just Arabs who got picked up in the wrong place, is not interesting. We sort of feel like, oh, they all hate us. And so whether they, you know, were holding a rifle or a Casio watch in some cases, which is the only thing that connects them to terrorism, or if they in fact were, you know, Osama bin Laden's driver is not interesting. Those are sort of details that don't interest us.
Dahlia Lithwick, what would your advice be to journalists who want to do an earnest job of covering Guantanamo and these human rights abuses?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is really saying over and over and over again, this is precisely what the administration wants. They don't give these prisoners names. They don't let us have images of them. They've put them on an island and then claimed we don't have jurisdiction. They've done everything possible to obliterate them. And so saying, well, I guess we won't pay attention, it feeds right into the sort of object here, which is to obliterate them. And I think we need to say, this isn't only a story when, like Abu Ghraib, we've got photographs. When we're not allowed to take photographs, that might be a bigger story, and that's our responsibility.
We've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick. You can read her column, Invisible Men, The Not People We're Not Holding at Guantanamo Bay, on Slate.com. That article includes links to each of the three studies we've been discussing. Dahlia Lithwick, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The situation in 2005 remains abysmal. Thus declares the latest global study of women in journalism. The Global Media Monitoring Project surveyed one day of coverage, February 16, 2005, in radio, TV, and newspapers in 76 countries. The findings should make clear to U.S. women, critical of their own underrepresentation in media, that at least they are in good company. That's because from Azerbaijan to Zimbabwe, as the report puts it, the same patterns emerge. People featured in news stories as spokespeople, 86% male. What stories are most likely to include women as subjects? Celebrity and art stories. What stories are least likely? Politics and the economy. Despite this obvious imbalance, how many stories address issues of gender inequity? A tiny fraction. No, it's not surprising. The project's findings have looked pretty much like this since their initial effort in 1995, but a situation doesn't have to be surprising to be urgent. Joining us now to discuss the latest evidence of women's lowly news status, which a recent column of hers calls a global insult, is Sheila Gibbons. She's the editor of the Media Report to Women and co-author of the book Taking Their Place, a documentary history of women and journalism. Welcome to Counterspin, Sheila Gibbons.
Thank you.
Well, you've been researching women in journalism for years now. I wonder, what is noteworthy to you about this project, this global media monitoring project?
One of the things that was noteworthy about it, Janine, is the magnitude of the project. People in 76 countries all monitoring newspapers, radio, and television reports on one day. The logistics of that impressed me, and the enterprise and dedication of people willing to do that are impressive also. The other piece is what they found, and that is that it's very consistent worldwide that this pattern of second-class status for women as subjects of news stories and also as the agents of news is consistent everywhere in developed countries and in less developed countries. And I think many journalists probably have assumed that in the more developed world that there would be more advanced and more enlightened portrayals of women. And this study showed that that just is not the case.
It sort of gives some context, doesn't it, to recent discussions we've been having in the U.S. about the representation of women that says, you know, this conversation's going on elsewhere, too.
Uh-huh.
Well, are there findings within the findings that you find striking? I noted, for example, the admixture of age. Nearly half of all male subjects are over 50, whereas nearly 75% of female news subjects are under 50. Were there other things like that that were particularly interesting to you in the data?
There is that, which I think shows a long-standing bias in favor of youth, certainly in North American culture, but not only here. There are also other things, and that is that in some news reporting, women simply are just not asked to be sources. One of the examples in the Global Media Monitoring Project study was that of a story on divorce. And I can't recall which country this story was published in, but not a single woman was interviewed for the article.
you know, omissions like that are hard to understand in this day and age.
Well, there are a couple of beats the study found that women seem to dominate, if you will, and I suppose that's interesting in its own right. What were those areas where you saw maybe more women than other areas?
Well, this would be where we're talking about women journalists, mm-hmm. and, you know, in news organizations, and they dominated only two, weather and poverty, housing, the welfare beat, being those two distinct areas. And I think that what we also see is a lot of women on television in what we would call the softer news areas. And weather, as popular as it is pretty much becoming more and more the domain of the female meteorologist. And that, I think, accounts for the prominence of women in that area. And the other area, of course, then, is poverty. Women do seem to take that sort of social worker beat. And I'm not really sure why that is, because I look at that as an economics beat as well.
Mm-hmm.
But as it translates in the study, those are the only two news beats where female reporters outnumber males.
Well, of course, it's not hard to see here the marks of broader cultures. Women's numbers seem to go up as reporters when it's television we're talking about, a more visual medium. Women are presented often as victims and that sort of thing. But I guess my question is, if media merely are reflecting the larger culture, and that larger culture in so many places around the world is sexist, what then is the purpose of pointing out inequities within journalism to journalists? Is there a special role or a special responsibility for journalists when it comes to gender issues?
I don't know that there's a special role really for any profession, but since journalism really does hold the mirror up to society, to politics, to international conflict, and it establishes a barometer by which we measure highs and lows, ups and downs, I do think that it's incumbent on journalism to take a closer look at these things, including at itself, to see how it's doing on the rankings, but it's pretty much blind to its own shortcomings.
They say the biggest sacred cow of the press is the press itself. Well, what about so-called new media, which were not included in the study? I know that that's something that you've written about yourself. Are there really new openings there? What's the same or what's different?
Well, so far what we know about the blogosphere, as it's come to be called, is that's still pretty much a boy sandbox too. There are more women blogging than ever before, but there are a lot more guys. I think that that may reflect the fact that, initially men caught into the Internet more quickly, not necessarily for news and research and information as women tend to, but more for the interactivity, the games, and that type of thing. But I think what it also does is reflect pretty much the dominance of male columnists, male editorial voices in traditional journalism. I think it is just, you know, tripped over into the Internet, and right now there's still a lack of balance there. But it's also a great place for women to establish themselves as voices, and I think it has worked very, very well for a number of women who have made the Internet their own. I think we'll see more of it.
Well, in terms of the Global Media Monitoring Project, finally, you might say the project itself is quite creditworthy, and you noted that, volunteers working all around the world. It sort of suggests women working around and working despite these big institutions that exclude them in itself as a project. What could you take away, or what ought people take away that is positive, that is constructive from this dismal, let's admit it, data?
I think that it's inspiring that you can get that many people cooperating, you know, on that many levels for that long. And then the report was a year in the making, you know, digesting the data, checking the data, and then, of course, doing a 150-page report, which is how long it is, that describes the endeavor and highlights pluses and minuses in different regions of the world. I think there's a lot of data there that we can use as leverage to improve things wherever we live. And if we add our own local analyses to that using similar methodology, you can get the attention of people who run news organizations, whether it's broadcast, cable, or print, and get them thinking that these deficits are going to be costly in terms of audience and circulation. And I think that's the approach that you can take with a study that was as ambitious as this one was.
We've been speaking with author Sheila Gibbons. You can read her recent column, Women's Lowly News Status is a Global Insult, on womensenews.org. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's program or you'd like to hear previous programs, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 24th of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Even as the White House releases its report on what went wrong during relief efforts of Hurricane Katrina, four tribes in the bayous of Louisiana are struggling to rebuild. Now the tribes have established a nonprofit organization to receive and distribute donations among the several thousand families that are trying to raise and rebuild their homes, in the hopes that pooling their resources will help preserve their way of life before it's destroyed. Andrew Stelzer reports.
Albert Nackin, chief of the Isle de Charles Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha Confederation of Muscogees, says 30 out of 52 homes of his tribe's members were flooded, basically any that were not more than 13 feet above the ground. FEMA trailers that were needed 5 months ago are trickling in one by one, and even then may not be usable.
We have people that can't afford a sewage system, and if you can't afford an updated sewage system, well, then you don't get your FEMA trailer.
Because the Gulf Coast tribes don't yet have federal recognition, aid from the U.S. government has been slow in coming, and Marlene Foray, chief of the Grand Kailu Dulac Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha, says the state of Louisiana is focusing on New Orleans.
Down in this area, like, you know, take Grand Kailu Dulac, we had one big grocery store down there, and it's gone. They're not reopening. You know, the industry's practically zero, except for the shrimping businesses, but there are a lot of them are folding and not reopening.
Chucky Verdon, chairman of the Pointe aux Chiens Indian tribe, says 35 Pointe aux Chiens homes were damaged by wind from Hurricane Katrina, and another 35 were damaged by floods from Rita. Verdon attributes much of the damage to the erosion of the marshes caused by an increasing amount of salt water due to levees built on the Mississippi River and canals dug by the oil companies.
The government's so slow in coming down here. Why come and try and save a small fishing community that I'm a fisherman. I've been following over the last 20 years where they're trying to get in us, do away with the commercial fishermen. And if they could get us out of here, that would be an easier way for them.
Foray says people haven't begun leaving, but as the 2006 hurricane season is approaching, she's concerned the continued existence of the tribes is in danger.
They're saying for us to leave and not come back when they're not going to help. I mean, what else are you supposed to look at?
From Pointe aux Chiens, Louisiana, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The controversy in Wisconsin continues over the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Chippewa Indians' application to be treated as a state under the Clean Water Act in order to manage its own water quality standards. Last week, the State Assembly Natural Resources Committee held its own public comment meeting, but the tribe, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Natural Resources Water Division all chose not to attend. Superior Broadcast Network's Nick Vanderpie has this update.
Several cranberry growers who share water with the tribe are concerned Flambeau's higher water quality standards could put the growers out of business. But Tom Molson, speaking as a Lac des Flambeaux tribal member, tells the growers not to worry.
We want to make sure what they put on their cranberries are going to be safe to eat.
The Federal Clean Water Act doesn't even allow regulation of cranberry growers. Andrew Hansen, an attorney representing the Madison-based Midwest Environmental Advocates, chastises the State Assembly Natural Resources Committee for not making this clear.
Not sham hearings that are set up to come and foment people's worst fears and get them riled up against the band. And that's what this hearing is today.
The meeting ended with Hazelhurst businessman Tom Tiffany claiming Flambeau's water quality application is a conspiracy of radical downstate environmentalists to turn the Northwoods into a federal wilderness. Tiffany worries Packaging Corporation of America's Tomahawk Paper Mill could be shut down if the EPA agrees to allow the ban to regulate its water quality standards.
Let's say they went by the wayside. I did a little exercise a couple years ago to see how much business I would lose. I'm a tourism-oriented business. I'd lose about 5 to 10% of my business.
I'm Nick Vanderpie in Lac de Flambeau.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie C. Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.